criminal justice system. And Dan Simon joins us from Southern California. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
The importance of psychological roles in the system, isn't that what juries are for?
Yes, but juries cannot do everything. There are lots and lots of inputs into the process. And the key here is to view the process in its entirety. Think of witnesses, think of victims, think of detectives, of forensic scientists, lawyers, judges, and of course jurors too. So it really is more about the overall human input into the process. And in fact, I think the emphasis should be more on the police investigation. We tend to focus on juries, but I don't think that's really the crux of the problem.
You say that the system is flawed at every stage, the evidentiary stage, the adjudicative phase, the deliberative phase. But what exactly, how are the investigations actually colored by bias and human cognitive error?
So, there are flaws in the various stages. I'm not here to say that the whole system is defunct. For the most part, I think that the majority of people who get convicted are indeed guilty of their crimes. But many of those cases are easy cases. They do not really require much investigation or adjudication for that matter. But we should be focusing on the difficult cases, the cases where it's not obvious who did it, and that's where the resources get put in. And in those cases, things can go wrong. We get, at the end of the day, I think that the evidence that gets presented in court is a mix of, for the most part, accurate evidence. That's because most people, function fairly well. And I think it's fair to assume that with some notable exceptions, most people try to do an honest and diligent job. But we do have mistakes, and those mistakes, some of them are just random error because we're human, but the key is that many of those mistakes were actually induced by the procedures that we use. We don't use the best available procedures, neither to investigate nor to adjudicate crimes.
You talk about the difference between spontaneous errors, where everybody just makes a mistake, as you say, meaning well and with best intentions. But then you do talk about the induced investigation errors. Will you explain those to us?
Sure. We all make mistakes. We're humans. We screw up every so often, and usually that's okay. We can, let's say, be introduced to somebody at a dinner party, and then 10 minutes into conversing with them, we forget their names. Or we walk down the street and we recognize someone, and we actually do know that person, but for some reason we cannot place where that memory is from. So those kinds of things can indeed actually result in, very terrible outcomes in the criminal justice process. Think of a witness or a victim who identifies a person who attacked her, let's say, but turns out that she recognizes the person simply because they work in the same hospital or they live three blocks away. So there is familiarity, and she's honestly doing a good, an honest job in picking out the person. But there's a problem with the memory. She remembers a person correctly, but she cannot correctly place where that memory is from. So these kinds of incidents can throw the process off. I don't see much room for changing this, that is, for fixing these problems. These are indeed, as you described them, these are spontaneous errors. But what we can change are the procedures that sometimes lead to errors. If we don't conduct the lineup correctly, and there happens to be some a biasing factor in the way we conduct the lineup, and that causes the witness to pick out the wrong person, well, then that's a serious problem. That's what we can call induced errors. And there are many, many, many examples of just how many ways in which we can actually perform these investigative procedures incorrectly. And that's really what I'm trying to get at here.
We're speaking with law and psychology professor Dan Simon of the University of Southern California, and we're talking about his book, In Doubt, the psychology of the criminal justice system. Professor, give us a thumbnail and run us by the Bruce Gottschalk affair with the two rapes, and how the witnesses were totally baffled by or influenced by the investigation.
Yes, so the case of Bruce Gottschalk is one of the cases that I discuss in the book. I do not discuss them in length because really the focus of the book is on the psychological research that helps us understand the process. But these cases, I believe, help illustrate the need for the psychological examination. So Bruce Gottschalk was a young man in Pennsylvania who was convicted at trial for two instances of burglary, which was breaking into homes, and of forcible rape. He was said to have assaulted one victim in each of those incidents. And there was a mountain of evidence against Gottschalk, including some forensics, including an identification by one of the victims. And ultimately, it was all capped by this very powerful confession that he made to having committed these two crimes. He provided in the taped recordings of the confessions, and I'll just point out that we have recordings of the ultimate confession, which, as I recall, was about 30 minutes long, but we do not have a record of the interrogation that led up to the confession. But in the confession, he admits to the crimes. He provides details which make it sound very realistic and genuine. And he even adds an apology to the victims for having committed those sexual assaults upon them. Turns out that Gottschalk did not commit these crimes, and DNA has excluded him quite conclusively, and indeed he is currently a free man. So the baffling things here are probably two. Why did a witness pick him out? And maybe more intriguingly, why did he confess to the crimes? I'm happy to go into those two questions, or would you like me to speak about something?
Well, maybe you could tell us, how is it that people confess to crimes that they didn't commit? I know they're under a lot of pressure and interrogation techniques, but still admitting to a crime and apologizing to the victims when you weren't the perpetrator, how does that happen?
Yes, that is indeed one of the most baffling and indeed troubling aspects of the criminal justice process. How does it happen? It happens because, despite the fact that for the most part, false confessors are not led to believe that they did actually commit the crime, that would be what we call an internalized false confession, and rarely that happens. People who are particularly suggestive or who might have been at the time of the incident intoxicated or otherwise impaired, so they might be convinced they committed it. But more often, those who confess falsely do so for strategic reasons. They believe that that's the best option that they can choose at that time. And at that time is a very, very sort of weak and problematic moment, usually following an intense and long interrogation with a tremendous amount of psychological pressure. Lots of psychological techniques are used to bring you to that situation. To please your interrogators in the hope mm-hmm. that they're your best chance. And when you are told that you are facing a very certain conviction and a very stiff punishment, at that time that seems to be the right thing to do.
Perhaps they might say, if you don't confess to this crime, we know you did it. You're certain to get the death penalty. But if you confess, we can mitigate that.
Yeah, so that is certainly the subtext of a lot of what's going on in the room. And we know of many cases where the death penalty was used as a threat to get people to confess. That is actually not legally permissible, but still, again, because we don't have a good record of interrogations, and one of the strong recommendations that I make in the book is that we can clean up a lot of the mess in the process by making the whole investigative procedure much more transparent. And if we taped, ideally videotaped, every single encounter with every witness, I think we would be preventing a lot of the mistakes that we currently have. But importantly, we will also be helping the prosecution to get the true perpetrators convicted. Because when you have good, reliable accounts of what transpired, let's say in an interrogation room, that actually oftentimes guts a lot of frivolous defense claims.
I have two questions regarding this. Aren't they videotaped now? Aren't the interrogations videotaped? Or you're saying it's not standard procedure?
Yes, it is not standard procedure. So, and this goes back to one of our endemic problems. If you compare, let's say, the American criminal justice to the one, let's say, in the United Kingdom, which is the closest comparison, there you have essentially one police force that sort of governs the whole kingdom. In the United States, we have about 18,000 police departments, and about 13,000 of them actually conduct criminal investigations. And you can't, short of rulings from the United States Supreme Court, there's no way to actually govern this behemoth. So indeed, the lack of standardization is one of our problems. So some jurisdictions, indeed, as you indicated, do tape the entire interrogation. Very few actually tape every encounter with every witness, which I think is what would be most desirable. But it would be great if we started with taping interrogations. They're a crucial part of many cases. So indeed, I don't know the exact percentage, but I would be happy if as many as 10% of our police departments across the country actually do tape interrogations.
Right. We're speaking with Professor Dan Simon of the University of Southern California. We're talking about his book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Stay with us. We'll be back with more.
Thanks for joining us today on Topical Currents. This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details and scheduling your event is available at 978-6-250-5387 online at fairtoremember.com.
Egypt's new president took a series of bold steps in recent weeks. He defied the country's military rulers, bombed Islamic militants in the Sinai, chose China as his first overseas trip in office, and now comes out in full support of the rebels in Syria, all while promising major changes at home. I'm Neil Conan, the New Egypt. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Coming up right after Topical Currents here on 91.3.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thank you so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with law and psychology professor Dan Simon about his book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Professor, we were talking about confessing to crimes that the suspect did not commit. And I want to go back to that, if you don't mind. Could we do that?
Sure.
Okay. In your book, you say that 94% of people, when asked, said that they would never confess to a crime that they didn't commit. And what were your findings of those 94% who said they would never do that?
Well, we don't have exact findings about those particular people. The point is more of a general one, is that the vast majority of the public believe, quite honestly, of course, that they would not confess to a crime they did not commit. The problem here, I'd say there are two problems. One is we're not very good, as just people in generally, at predicting how we will behave under different types of circumstances, particularly extraneous sentences, circumstances, where there's a tremendous amount of pressure applied on us. That's a finding that just has been made in lots of other domains in psychology. So the bottom line is that the truth is that many of those 90% of the people actually would confess had they been put under these difficult circumstances. Second point is I'm not quite sure why we make the inferences that we do from that belief, which, as I mentioned, I think is at least in part is false. So the inference is I would not confess to a crime I did not commit. The defendant in this particular case confessed to a crime that he says he did not commit. But if I wouldn't confess and he did, I wouldn't commit the crime. Maybe he did commit the crime. It's this inference that because I wouldn't make that mistake or, you know, make that confession because I'm innocent, he made the confession, therefore he's guilty. So I'm not quite sure about the logic of that inference. It's very intuitive and it's commonly shared by many people. But really, that's a bit of one of these kind of fallacious inferences that can lead to pretty bad outcomes. The truth is that guilty people, truly guilty people, actually have as much, if not even more, of a reason not to confess. Confession is always a very self-defeating proposition. So anyway, it's just a long way of saying that this is one of the sort of the common beliefs that people hold, presumably jurors hold them too, that can lead to incorrect inferences. And when it comes to a crime that hinges on a confession, oftentimes that's all that there is to convict this person. So if the confession that's presented to the jurors is misunderstood as being truthful, even though it's not, it very often ends up leading to a false conviction. And indeed, out of the data that we have of false convictions, a full 25% of the cases were based on false confessions. Hmm. It's quite a problem.
That's a staggering number.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in on today's topical currents, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email is open. That's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Professor Dan Simon, why do we have to have an adversarial criminal process? Just because of the history of going back to English law?
Yes, that is, I think, the correct explanation of why we have it. Why we continue to have it, it's probably very deeply entrenched in our culture. We're great believers in the adversarial system. I'm a bit skeptical about it. Not that I think that there are these perfect alternatives, but the adversarial system brings a certain level of pathology with it. These are the endemic problems that occur whenever people or groups are in competition with each other. We know that competition just spurs stronger motivation to succeed, and in some situations you can see how that contributes to being a bit less scrupulous about facts, perhaps hiding facts that don't seem to work your way, exaggerating your stories or your narratives. And oftentimes, as you know, is commonly held, you know, the guy with the more eloquent lawyer wins the case. I would love to see the criminal justice system be driven first and foremost by a genuine search for truth. I don't think this is like other types of our public lives where we can, you know, kind of wash our hands of the truth and say, okay, we can be relativistic about this and understand that, you know, different cultural or political perspectives are all okay and we have to embrace them all. No, this is where I think we really should strive to get at the truth. Putting people away for many years or sometimes killing them based on factual mistakes is just a horrendous proposition. It's bound to happen every so often, but to the extent that we can feasibly minimize the occurrence, I think it's incumbent on us to do that.
I have an email over here. What drives prosecutors' efforts to keep innocent people in prison?
First I'd like to say that there are many prosecutors out there, and more so today than in the past, who very quickly understand and appreciate that they're going to have some you know mistaken convictions on their desks, and they're quick to fix them. At the same time, there are still are prosecutors, and we had some pretty ugly examples from, let's say, Lake County in Illinois just in the past few months, where prosecutors are just clinging onto convictions in the face of really compelling evidence of innocence. And your listener asks why, and the answer is it's for the same reasons that many of us stick to our guns when we're under pressure. It's hard for us to admit our own mistakes or even the mistakes of our team members, maybe our predecessors of our profession. Sometimes it's hard to admit that the tools that we use to convict people day in, day out in court, like the types of evidence, say an eyewitness identification or a confession. So it's difficult for us to admit that these tools upon which our profession and our professional identity relies are sometimes defunct. Some prosecutors are what we call true believers. They just believe way too strongly in their ability to find truth and the need to punish people sometimes at all costs. There are a host of reasons.
They may also be elected officials.
They might be elected officials, and then they might perceive correctly or not that sticking to the guns is advantageous for their next election. It very much depends on the local climate and the particular case. It's very complicated, and the adversarial system adds its extra, you know, bit of fuel to the fire. There's a sense of zero-sum game. So letting off a guy is a win for the defense and a loss for the prosecution. So they oftentimes frame the issues in this adversarial mindset, and they forget that their other duty is to be what the Supreme Court called the duty of the Minister of Justice. You're not just an adversary in this adversarial process, you're also a bureaucrat who's vested with tremendous powers and discretion to actually make policy choices and to decide on specific cases. When is it merited to prosecute a person, and when is it merited to ask a court to overturn a conviction? So that's a double role, it's a role conflict that prosecutors are put in. And some prosecutors handle it better than others.
What is your view of the Innocence Project and the results, and do you have any participation with that?
So I'm personally not involved in the Innocence Project. My opinion of the Innocence Project is that they've, and let me just point out that there is one sort of Innocence Project that's based in New York City, the one that's the better known than others. It's founded by Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld. But there are actually many other Innocence Projects strewn across the country. They are not officially affiliated with what we call the Innocence Project. As for my opinion, I think that the Innocence Project or projects have actually made a very important contribution to the debate. First and foremost, they've gotten hundreds of people out of prison, innocent people who've spent, you know, tens of thousands of years cumulatively, and that's very important. I think at a more sort of deeper level, they've affected the debate in an important way because they've brought home the realization that was pretty much suppressed or ignored, I'd say, as recent as 10, 15 years ago, that the system isn't perfect, that the system makes mistakes. And today, I think there's a much greater sort of openness, not just in the general public, but also in people who operationalize the law enforcement, enforcement agencies such as, you know, police departments, prosecutors, judges, and such. We understand that we're dealing with a much more complicated and nuanced process that is somewhat prone to error. And that's a very important ice to crack in order to, you know, sit down with these people and say, okay, let's try and fix the procedures. It was harder to do when people were in denial and thought, as pretty much the Supreme Court continues to think to this day, that the system is almost impeccable.
Well, you mentioned what Justice Scalia has said about the false convictions. That's very telling.
It is indeed. But it's not just Justice Scalia. You know, he's just a bit more poignant about this. But you know, just as recently as January of this year, the Supreme Court came down in a majority of 8 justices to 1 in deciding on a particular case. And it's not so important what the particular holding was, but what is important is that they reaffirmed this belief that the federal constitution has very little to do with the way the actual process is actually conducted at the local state levels, and importantly that the due process clause is pretty much mostly about making sure that cops don't, you know, cheat and lie and misbehave. And as long as they don't find that official misconduct, the fact that evidence is unreliable does not create a due process problem. Mm. And this is a huge issue where I think the court is wrong. The court should care about the integrity of the evidence. The evidence is the building block of convictions. It's the essence of what goes on in the courtroom. And we can't just wash our hands and ignore it and just let any, you know, police detective in one of those many thousands departments do as they please, not create a record of what they do, and as long as they can convince a jury, oftentimes based on mistaken evidence, then we're okay. That is due process. No, I think we owe defendants and suspects and even guilty people a duty to actually figure out their guilt correctly before we put them away.
Right.
We're speaking with professor and author Dan Simon about his book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with more.
Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and online at fairtoremember.com.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Nacional Funeral Homes. Nacional is committed to welcoming all families and finding a way to accommodate them in their time of grief and loss, regardless of their means. Information at 305-910-4169.
And we're back, 33 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you along with colleague Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dan Simon about his book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Professor, is there a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Yes, indeed, there is. The book itself has a website, which is indoubt.net. And it also contains quite a lot of resources and links to other organizations and governmental agencies if people want to look further into these topics.
Again, our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email radio@WLRN.org. First caller. Whoops.
Speaking of which.
Sounds like the cops are after him. Remy and Perrine, hi.
Yeah, no, I wanted to ask the gentleman if there was any correlation with income of the suspect. Yeah, or was that mutually exclusive? Because he mentioned something about eloquent lawyer, and that normally translates into a lawyer well paid.
And also ethnicity.
And all.
But they tend to correlate. Right. Unfortunately.
Okay, kind of have a bad connection, Remy, but the professor will address you.
Off the air is fine with me.
Okay, very good.
That's a fair question. I'd say that we don't have data, or at least I'm not aware of data about correlations. But what we can see, at least sort of just from a rough look at the system, basically you can divide criminal justice cases into two categories. One being specifically white collar crimes, and there you have a much more balanced system. Really well paid lawyers for the most part. And those cases look a bit more like what you'd expect from an adversarial system. A lot of the information and the evidence is actually also held by the defendants themselves. It's documents and phone calls they made and such. But that's a small sliver of the entire sort of pool of cases. The vast majority of other crimes, think violent crimes, property crimes, drug crimes, domestic violence and such, they're for the most part, the suspects and defendants are not wealthy. They oftentimes rely on court-appointed lawyers or public defenders who tend to be overworked and underpaid, and that's where you get these big disparities in both. And I'm not saying, by the way, that the prosecutorial side is always well-funded and well-manned, but there are disparities in these cases. Oftentimes, investigations take place while the suspects are in prison. They're under arrest, and they don't have really good access to the evidence. So you get this accumulation of an informational disparity, a representational disparity, which don't bode well for many of these defendants.
How does media coverage and the families of the victims and community pressure, how does that affect the judicial process, do you feel?
Well, it can affect in at least two different ways. One is the more pressure and public interest there is at the time of the police investigation, this is what we call high-profile crimes, that puts a lot of pressure on the police to clear those crimes, to do so quickly, and that's where you sort of, like you see in the movies or TV series, you know, the mayor calls the police chief and yells at him, and the police chief calls the lieutenant and the detective department and yells at them, you know, let's solve this case, we're taking too much heat.
Right.
And that's usually not a good thing for an investigation. An investigation is actually a very a difficult chore. It's got lots of objective difficulties. There are lots of room for cognitive mistakes and such. You don't want that pressure. And by the way, some of this is induced internally by the detectives. If they have a high-profile case on their hands, that could mean, you know, a professional career success or failure, and that could affect their own personal calculations too. So it's just not a good thing, but it's inevitable. What can we do? Some crimes just do indeed jolt the community, and they attract that pressure. The second way in which the sort of media and public attention can throw a case off, or at least, you know, complicated, is when we get to trial. And the jurors, or the jury pool, is more likely going to be familiar with the facts of the case, or at least the media reports of the facts of the case. So it's harder to get people with an open mind. You know, they're asked about their knowledge and their sort of inclinations before they're impaneled and put on into the jury box, but that is not a very good guarantee. And the data show that pre-trial publicity actually has quite a strong impact on verdicts. And I'll just say that most of the pre-trial publicity, think of, let's say, TV coverage, comes from either the police or from the defense. And clearly these lawyers are trying to game the system, or at least oftentimes they are, and it's usually they're playing the jurors through the media, and that's not a healthy thing.
Of course, here in Florida, we've endured this whole Trayvon Martin saga with a small Sanford, Florida police department and the tremendous pressure that was put on to make an arrest and to prosecute George Zimmerman. And I was just wondering what you think of that. And also the judge has now had to recuse himself because of making prejudicial remarks during some of the proceedings.
Yeah.
Is that a good example of too much publicity on one case?
Absolutely. It's also the problem of having a very difficult, and this is objectively a very difficult investigation, done by, you know, a very small police department with, you know, I don't know the department and I don't know the portfolio of cases, but this is probably much bigger than any of the detectives there have seen in their lives. So that's already a problem of specialization. But certainly the amount of pressure. And then as a detective or a police chief or as a judge, you keep on second-guessing yourself. How is this going to look in the media? What does this do to my career? What is my professional milieu going to think of what I'm doing? You know, and you're just so busy second-guessing and, you know, correcting and overcorrecting. That's, you know, not an ideal set of circumstances for such a complicated and indeed sensitive topic.
We have more callers. Next up, we have a Fort Lauderdale listener. This is Ira. Hello, Ira. How are you?
Hi. I was a court reporter for many years. I worked for both state's attorney's offices, which are prosecutors, and grand juries. And I overheard a lot of conversations, and I cannot recall one single conversation on the prosecutorial side that had anything to do with justice. It was always get the conviction, get the conviction, get the conviction. Now, I'm not saying that I ever saw anybody phony up evidence or frame anybody, but I have seen prosecutors fight to the death to get evidence to make it inadmissible based on some technicality, even though that evidence casts really, really serious doubt on the guilt of the accused. And you would think that anybody interested in justice might not fight that hard to get something exculpatory out.
Professor?
Yes. You know, Ira's making a very powerful point, and it goes to the core of what is the system about. And sort of if you look through the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this matter, and it permeates through, you know, lower courts, and ultimately to prosecutors and police detectives and defense attorneys, it is indeed about something that Ira's touching upon, and that is it's almost like a shell game. There are procedural and constitutional rights and obligations that the various parties have, and that's the rule of the game. And the point is that all of these procedures and constitutional provisions are intended and designed, at least in theory, to find the truth. They are just supposed to be the means towards the goal, which is the truth. But as is often the case in these kind of proceduralized regimes, the form takes over from the substance. The rules take over from the ultimate values of the system. So what you have then, and especially in our adversarial system, which as Ira mentioned is quite pervades the discourse at the level of the people who operate it, is that winning the game within the rules is doing your job correctly. But winning the game in the case of a prosecutor is getting a conviction, and it's conversely true for a defense attorney is getting an acquittal, but neither of those are necessarily correspond with the truth. And sort of seems like Ira and I and maybe a handful of other people seem to care about the truth, which just sort of gets lost in the shuffle. And this is a very sort of, it goes to the core, it goes to the mission of the system. And this is where I think the Supreme Court is the only body that can actually do much about that. But as I mentioned, they're showing absolutely no indication of doing so. I will point out, however, that there is some room for optimism. Because what we see is some grassroots attention and care and very serious attempts to fix this. So you see this at the level of various states. Some states have just, in the past few years, mostly because of the question of innocence and oftentimes following some embarrassing exonerations, but states have actually gotten their act together, whether it's legislators or Supreme Courts of states. So states such as North Carolina, New Jersey, Wisconsin, and others, and also local jurisdictions. Dallas County, Texas, is light years ahead of almost any county in the country in its attempt to actually get to the truth of criminal cases. So that's on that's the positive side. Unfortunately, that's going to be a slow process. It's not most very efficient. It's quite costly. I wish that these truths, sort of these reorientations of what the system is about, would actually come from the top down, i.e., from the U.S. Supreme Court.
So, what reforms is Dallas implementing that are so hopeful?
So, Dallas, so the reforms are on sort of the two ends of the process. First, and I think the most important, is that the Dallas district attorney, a gentleman by the name of Craig Watkins, has just made it a mission to just get the cases right. He's teamed up with the Dallas police chief, and they've implemented reforms, including very good practices for conducting lineups, that is, identifications of suspects. They tape much more of the investigation, certainly interrogations, but also other interviews. They share all the evidence openly, with some narrow exceptions, with the defense. So they've really cleared up the process. Mm-hmm. If you're an innocent suspect, you'd much rather be in Dallas today than pretty much anywhere else in the country. On the back end, Dallas has established what they call, this is inside the DA's office, they've established what they call the Conviction Integrity Unit. So think of it like a quality control unit in, let's say, a factory, and their job is to go and find the flaws and to fix them when they come across false convictions. That's very important. It brings this whole awareness that we might be making mistakes, and how to fix mistakes. And indeed, Dallas County has exonerated I believe it's 20-odd people in the past few years, which is way more than anywhere else in the country. That is also because even the previous regimes in Dallas, which included district attorneys who did not a particularly commendable job on the question of innocence, at least they did preserve the evidence, which enables the current DA to actually do a much more meaningful and effective tests, like, for example, do DNA tests, which is the best way to get people off.
And that's not standard procedure, doing DNA testing?
Well, so access to DNA is something that all but one or two states actually have in their state statutes, but it's not routinely done in investigations. That depends on the departments, depends on their budgets, depends on their professionalization. But post-conviction, and by the way, let me just say that wherever DNA is available, I strongly recommend that it gets tested. At the investigative phase, it's a great investigative tool, and it can save, you know, a lot of effort and the risk of error.
Right.
At the same time, we shouldn't place too much hope on DNA testing, because biological evidence is oftentimes just not available. The rough estimate that only about 10 or 15% of serious felonies have any chance to find any sort of biological evidence at the crime scene. So that's no substitute for doing all the other low-tech kind of investigations in the best available manner that we can.
Right. We're speaking with Professor Dan Simon about his book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Back to our callers. This is Chris in Miami. Hello, Chris.
Hi. I had a comment on what Ira just said, and then something else to ask the professor about. My experience as a prosecutor in Miami-Dade County was that prosecutors have an unusual ethical obligation, an obligation that no other lawyer has, and that is to do justice. And the rules are skewed appropriately, heavily in favor of the defendant in a criminal case. So what I receive in court is just a very small part of what a prosecutor's job is. There's quite a bit of evaluating justice before a case gets filed. What I wanted to ask the professor about was this. My experience in front of juries was that juries are very well equipped to determine certain types of issues in cases, namely, was self-defense valid, or what is self-defense indeed a basis for acquittal? What is the level of criminal intent in a given case? So when you have a why done it as opposed to a who done it, my experience was juries are pretty good at that kind of thing. So the Trayvon Martin case, for example, I think is one where a jury is very likely, much more likely to get it right than in a who done it, where you're dealing with scientific evidence or identification issues, where I think juries have a much, much harder time. And I'm curious as to what you think about that.
Yeah, I think you're raising very interesting points. I'll just start off with your comment about prosecutors' obligation, professional obligation, and ethical obligation to find the truth. It's certainly there, and it's certainly part of the mix. And again, some prosecutors, I think, handle this in the correct. They balance their duties correctly. I'm just not sure that it's sufficiently balanced across the board, and we see some cases where it obviously isn't. And I'll just point out that what Ira, as I believe, said, he was also a court reporter in the grand jury hearings. And that's off sort of stage, that's in the backstage. And what he's saying is that a lot of the just casual discussions that are not public just convey much more of a, that the operative objective is to, you know, win the case rather than to, you know, seek justice, or are we really getting at the truth of things? Your second point, I think, is very true and resonates with my thinking on this. There are some aspects that the kind of research that I bring to the table, psychological experimentation, which I might say, just as an aside, a good deal of some of the best work comes out of your jurisdiction, WLRN. There are very good people at Florida International University, like Ron Fisher and Dan Wright, who just do tremendously useful and instructive work. The kind of research that we bring to the table is indeed not very well equipped for the kinds of questions that and I'm sorry, I forget the name of the listener, who's a prosecutor. The why questions. So determining the value judgments, what is reasonable, what is not, trying to figure out the human mind, intents and such. Our experimentation is actually quite poor in revealing much about those kinds of questions. The research is much better at the kinds of questions that I would call just factual determinations, the discernible facts, which indeed overlaps with the listener's category of who did it. So yes, we're much better at determining is an identification correct, is a memory report correct, and actually we're actually even better determining not whether a particular report was correct, but whether the procedure that was used is the best procedure or not. The science cannot really isolate individual cases and peg probabilities of accuracy on them. We can talk just on averages, on tendencies. And indeed, I see the major sort of mission of experimental legal psychology as figuring out the procedures that we should follow in the future. I think that's the best value that this discipline can bring to the table.
You know, I forgot our listener's name as well, that just called the prosecutor, but one of the things he mentioned was how, well, basically that the system favors the defendant, that it, and in your book, you're saying just the opposite, that the criminal justice system does not favor the defendant.
Yes. What I'm really saying is that, indeed, I think there are advantages to both sides. Now, some people find solace in that, and they say, okay, so overall the playing field is level. I actually don't. So certainly it is correct. The defendant enjoys many advantages. Think of the burden of truth. The presumption of innocence. The defendant can appeal convictions, but not the prosecutor cannot appeal acquittals, and so on and so forth. So those are indeed safeguards that do favor defendants. My point is that what we are missing in this debate is the ways in which defendants are disadvantaged, and mostly on the informational front. And by and large, and again, this is true for the run-of-the-mill cases, a bit less so for white-collar crimes, most defendants are at a substantial disadvantage because they do not have the capability or resources or legal powers to conduct investigations. They're oftentimes in a holding cell when the investigation is conducted. And a lot of the evidence that gets collected in the course of the investigation is never really shared with them. There are some Supreme Court rules called the Brady rules about the prosecutor's duty to disclose exonerating facts, but the borders are very wishy-washy. It's very hard to enforce it, and indeed quite a lot of prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct has been found in this domain. So it's a very complicated, not always so one-sided picture as to who has the advantages. If I were a defendant, I would probably want to go with knowing more about the case, knowing more about what other witnesses told the police, that maybe it wasn't me.
Professor
that
Dan
information
Simon
never got there.
Professor Dan Simon, it's been a very interesting hour we've spent with you. Dan Simon is a law and psychology professor at the University of Southern California, and he's written the book, In Doubt, The Psychology of the Criminal Justice System. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
And that wraps up today's program. My apologies to the callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gave production assistance, as did Peter Jay. Find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and also author and book links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like as well. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. Thursday, it's the story of the importance of agricultural seeds. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. Traditional Irish cooking. And today's calendar, on this day in 1535, 477 years ago, Pope Paul II excommunicates English King Henry VIII because of his divorce of Catherine of Aragon and marriage to Anne Boleyn. And on this day in 1882, 120 years ago, the first use of public electric lighting at Grand Central Station in New York City. And one more while we ponder George McGovern in 1972. On this day in 1929, 83 years ago, the birth in St. Louis of Senator Thomas Eagleton. After he was nominated by Democrats for vice president, reports of psychiatric treatment surfaced, and he was forced to step down from the McGovern campaign. Kennedy family member Sergeant Shriver ran instead. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And so we leave with a thought from King Henry VIII at the end of his reign in 1547 after having six wives. Quote, "Men's evil manners live in brass, their virtues we write in water." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.